are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Hey, we're sponsored this week by Decode DC, the podcast that gives you an honest look into how politics affects your life. The host of Decode DC, Jimmy Williams, you got to hear this guy. I actually sat on a couple of panels with him back in the Dylan Radigan days on MSNBC. I'm not sure if he's still going on, but he's worked in politics on both sides of the aisle, worked as a lobbyist, knows what he's talking about, and he takes all that experience and he's explaining how things really work inside and outside of Washington. Decode DC is smart, surprising. It challenges the conventional wisdom. Like in their recent episode about salt and why the government decided to push food makers to reduce sodium. Also, they got a show about how corporations have found a backdoor way to lobby the public and the government. Check it out. I did. I think you'll love it. That's Decode DC, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 29th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Today, Steve Mims, director of the documentary Starve the Beast, a film about the right wing's methodical destruction of our state-sponsored higher education. Also on the program today, budget deal to avert a shutdown in the works includes some money for Flint, Michigan, and then also some crap you won't like. It's Paul Ryan's world, folks. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's company violated the Cuban embargo. Polls in... He imported hundreds of boxes of tissues and other things. Who knows? He's probably the one who opened it up. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have good relations with Cuba now.
Yeah, black guys always take credit for the white man's work.
Polls in key battleground states show the debate helped Hillary Clinton. And Gary Johnson has another Gary Johnson moment.
Whoa, man.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump, longtime fat shamer, apparently still even fat shaming today. 10 state election databases breached by hackers. It's according to the FBI. Cable news has had a massive haul this campaign season. And the nationwide prison strike is now in its third week. And in North Dakota, a caravan of word water protectors stopped, at least temporarily, construction on the Dakota Access Pipeline. And the DEA, as of tomorrow, I believe, is going to put kratom on the Schedule 1 list of illegal drugs in this country. Apparently, this is an opium substitute that people turn to for pain relief. And, of course, the DEA is going to prevent ongoing studies of its efficacy and safety. Even according to the DEA, apparently, there's been maybe 15 deaths from kratom over the past 2 years. And upon further sort of more in-depth analysis, only one of them was solely a function of kratom. The rest were multiple drugs that people took. Whereas you have like hundreds of opium overdoses in any small region of the country over the past year. So I don't know too much about this, but we have at least one listener who was relying on this stuff for pain relief. And it just seems shocking when you know that there is this epidemic of opioid addiction around the country. To a large extent, I mean, I don't know if it's all can be, but you've had opioids overprescribed, and then you had painkillers that were sold to the public as being one which you didn't have to take a series of small doses for, and that had a sort of a longer lasting impact, and it turns out, well, it wasn't really the case, and it basically then ended up creating a whole wave of addicts. And then, of course, when you can't get your prescription drugs, you start buying some type of substitute on the streets. You buy heroin on the streets, and that's where we're at now. So one would think that just even a reasonable, level-headed perspective would be, well, we have this other drug that appears to be effective, is maybe we should just study it for an extended period of time or make it possible for people to study it. That apparently is not what the DEA... I mean, that's what's problematic with the DEA, right? Like, you don't want to... I mean, I'm not going to sit here and advocate for no politics, because then I won't have anything to talk about. The DEA, therefore, I think, has a sort of a vested interest in, but who knows? I'm going to dig into it more. But all right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, this is a pre-recorded interview I did with the director, Steve Mims, of this film, Starving the Beast, that is playing around the country right now. And you can go to Starve the Beast, I think it is. StarveTheBeast.com, is that it, Michael?
Yeah.
And we have that on... on the website. It's
starvingthebeast.net.
Starvingthebeast.net.
Link to on our page.
To find more information about this movie. It's a great movie, and it also puts into context what we're seeing around the country. I mean, every now and then I get a sense of what is coming next with the right wing in some instances. I mean, I think I mentioned to Steve Mims, and certainly I've told this story back in 2009, maybe it was, 2009 or 2010, Janine Garofalo and I got invited to the Aspen Ideas Festival. I still have a very, very bright orange saddlebag from it, which I may get rid of. I don't know why it had to be that color. They couldn't have just made it black, because it's a good bag. But nevertheless... I was to host a comedy show, like a comedy panel show, with Janine and maybe a little bit of a debate with Janine, and I think there was another writer on there. I can't remember who it was, but also Grover Norquist. And I thought this should be interesting. It wasn't recorded in any fashion. And Grover Norquist sat there like a robot and just kept repeating over and over again how public sector workers were getting away with murder by having good pensions. Now, the idea in and of itself was, sort of, I found repulsive. just sort of advocating for we should, you know, a race to the bottom in terms of taking care of the American worker. But he also wouldn't stop saying it, like almost in a completely non sequitur. Like I would just say, like, how are you finding Aspen, you know, Grover? And he would say, the public sector workers here have a pension. And at one point I had to say to him, like, you realize, like, we're not recording this. There's no other audience. They've all heard your spiel about how you don't want public sector workers to have a good pension. Why do you keep repeating it? It's true. And
it's really true.
And then what did we see in the coming years? You see three or four states, Indiana and Michigan and Wisconsin and more, attempt to become right-to-work states. In Wisconsin, they attack the public sector unions. You see this across the board. You see this case Friedrichs make its way up to the Supreme Court. Fortunately, Antonin Scalia died. And we didn't lose.
Celebrate. Good
exactly.
Times. Come on.
Yeah. And
pull that one too.
And the assault on public universities has that similar feel. Like you'll hear about it. I mean, there's been a half a dozen. Maybe they've taken place in your state and you're aware of it. I remind you too that, and this never even comes up in the movie, but as the cost of state universities go up, that creates upward pressure on private universities in terms of their tuition costs, or I should say their prices. So it's important. The other thing, too, I keep hearing about is state parks, federal parks. But we'll get into that in a bit. All right, quick break. When we come back, Steve Mims, Starving the Beast. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I have with us the director and writer of the documentary recently released, Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. Steve Mims, also a lecturer at the University of Texas, Austin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I should broadly say this is, I guess, an exploration of what is happening to some of our largest and probably not our largest across the country, but our public university system throughout the country. Let's just start with what was it that drove you to make the film?
Well, I live in Austin, Texas. And my partner in the film is a guy named Bill Benosky. He's in the film business. And together, we had worked together on a film about the death penalty years ago called Incendiary. And we were reading in the newspaper about this controversial thing that Rick Perry, the governor at the time, was doing. He appointed people to the Board of Regents for UT Austin and for Texas A&M. And he appointed them with a mission to go inside those universities and to begin the process of remaking them from the inside out. And for perspective, UT Austin and Texas A&M, they are our flagship research universities. So they're very highly regarded, like both schools attract people from all over the world. And so this is an interesting situation. And what drew our attention to it beyond his appointment is the fact that it caused a great controversy on both campuses. There were protests. There were people in the administration who got fired or who people wanted to be fired. There was a board of regents for UT Austin who became under investigation by the House, the State House, and was almost impeached. It turned into this remarkable story about these institutions that never make the news in that way. In other words, board of regents, you know, they're mostly very successful, wealthy guys who get appointed, and they spend money. You know, like there's nothing controversial about it. Like they build buildings, they spend money. And this turned into an all-out brawl. And so that's how we started. And as we did our research, we met people who told us, like, well, you know, this is not unique. This is happening, or variations of this, or is happening all over the country at different universities. And so we were led to UVA, and then to the Wisconsin, LSU, and North Carolina Chapel Hill.
All right, so let's talk about the dynamic. You start off the film with this exploration of what happened in Texas, and also it's what happened in Texas specifically centered around. Maybe centered is the wrong is too strong of a word, but it was the fulcrum of it was around this idea of disruptive innovation. And I have to say, whenever I hear disruptive innovation, and particularly anything that has to do that intersects in any way with public policy, you know there's going to be a problem. And I think, you know, this story about public higher education is indicative of a dynamic that is taking place across all public education across the country in many respects. All right, but tell us about how this the innovator's dilemma and disruptive innovation plays a part in this story.
Well, there are people who have a market orientation to how public universities should be reformed, and they believe that when they talk about the history of public universities, they'll say, well, maybe it was okay that in 1862, with the Morrill Act, that Lincoln did what he did, and which was a way to fund public universities all over the country. And maybe it was okay in World War II, where we invested all this research money to help win the war and, like, put us way ahead in every field. But now they say, we're in a new era. We're in the era of Google. We're in the era of disruptive innovation. And what we have are these large legacy institutions. And they have all of this, for one thing, they have this giant physical plant. Like, they have all these buildings. They have all these employees that are redundant. They basically are ripe for disruptive innovation, that we should remake them and we should build them around the technology. We can take all this technology and we can rethink everything. And so we can make the whole process cheaper, more affordable. And for some of them, a bonus is we can also maybe not pay for people who are sharing ideas that we don't agree with, like, or who are wasting our time with frivolous classes or frivolous studies. And so as far as the disruptive innovation goes, you know, this is, in this case, it is looking at every possible way to reinvent these institutions, make them cost less, and also measure them by money. So we literally have examples of the film where they took salaries of professors at Texas A&M, and they did the math, and they figured that, well, this guy he costs the university money. He doesn't make the university money. Maybe he's an English professor. Whereas we have this researcher in geology, and that person makes money for the university. And they literally measure the worth of the faculty by whether they are a profit maker or not. And so
let me tease this out and explain to people. So there was they call it the red black list, and
the red and black report. Yes,
and they'd literally put a dollar figure associated with people. Like I mean, what's interesting about this dilemma? I mean, what this situation is that, like, it, you know, you could say, like, well, what kind of methodology are they using, and et cetera, et cetera, to determine that number, right? Like, you know, how do you measure?
Right.
It's one thing to say, oh, this geology professor who does research there, they got a grant from the U.S. government that is worth $250,000 more than that guy's or that woman's annual salary. So they are in the black for this year, whereas the professor got not. But the other question is, and this is what I want to get at, too, about this whole notion of disruptive innovation.
And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the specifics as they play out in these different schools. But disruptive innovation, theoretically, is a means, right? Like, it is in business, of course, we have a very specific ends that is associated with business, that it, more or less, there's broad agreement as to what that ends is. But it seems to me the whole disruptive innovation, and I'm speaking sort of broadly on this whole reform movement through education, does not accept the same or the status quo premise of what the ends is supposed to be. And instead of arguing that fight, because that's a fight that doesn't sound very good to people's ears, I think a lot of the time, they fight the means fight, which is sort of necessarily tied into a different end. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, the irony about disruptive innovation is that you have the guy who came up with that concept, and I'm blanking on his name right now. He took something that had happened.
Clayton Christensen.
Clayton Christensen. So he took something that had happened because of an invention or a series of inventions. And he turned that around. Like, let me back up. So you have the status quo, and all of a sudden there's an iPhone, and now the iPhone, for me personally, that's my alarm clock, it's my calendar, it's my phone, it's my video player, it's my audio player, it's a browser. It has all this stuff. Well, naturally, that thing takes off. You displace all these other categories of products because people don't need them anymore. That is disruptive, right? But Christensen turned it around. He said that it was a strategy. And so you have all these people who are supposedly very, very smart, and they're advocating disruptive innovation, and they have this blanket thing that essentially, like, everything should be disrupted. In other words, all the, these legacy old institutions must be rethought and reinvented, even if the measurement that we use, like in higher education, is the money, rather than having well-rounded citizens, even if that's the way we measure it. So it's a completely backwards way to look at it. And we have a guy in the film who's just brilliant. His first name is Siva. He is a professor at the University of Virginia. And he goes on and on about this. And it points out something. It's one of those emperor has no clothes moments about these theories, that it's one thing to have a valid technology disrupt things. It's totally artificial to prescribe that as a thing that must happen. That's almost like the way they talk about it. It's preordained. This is going to happen. It should happen. And if, oh, by the way, our experiments generate massive unemployment, and we result with a educated college student who's not well-rounded anymore because we don't value the stuff that we measure by dollars, then that's just the way it is. I mean, people have come to accept that whole field, like journalism and everything else, is going to suffer because we have to adopt this idea. And to say anything negative about it, it's just to be sort of like a person advocating for a horse and buggy solution to, or a buggy whip solution, if you will.
But, I mean, that's where the shift happens, right? Because a horse and buggy seems ridiculous if the goal is relative to a car, if the goal is to get from point A to point B. And they are really attacking the idea of getting from point A to point B, but pretending that they're attacking the horse and buggy, it seems to me. Now, and you would have a better notion of this as you talk to him. I'm curious, as you see, talk about the sort of the general formula, because the general formula is just that, right? Where we're going to put, we're going to impose market-based metrics upon a place whose agenda is not the same as sort of, you know, a market.
A normal, right. That's exactly it. And you have to step back and look at where these guys are coming from. And I have to say this, it is a legitimate debate, right? It's a big philosophical debate, because if you look at the history of public higher ed, the idea from Jefferson and then Lincoln was that we're going to pour the money, federal money and state money, into these inefficient schools. And we're going to do it because in the end, we're going to generate engineers and doctors and people in agriculture and everything else. And they're going to build out the country. And that is literally what happened. Like, you can look at the history of this and go, like, this is wildly successful. Like, we have these land-grant institutions and then other great research institutions like UT that's not land-grant. And they have populated the country with professionals who have built it out, if you think about where we were in 1862. And you can objectively say, like, if you have a market orientation, all you have to do is look at how these schools attract people from overseas. We visited campuses all over the country, and there are plenty of people who pay a premium. They pay the highest level for tuition, and they send their kids here from all over the world because they know that it's worth it. But they're going to pay a lot, but the kids are going to come out with a degree that's going to be valuable, and they're going to have a career, and they can go back home and do it, or they can do it here. So if you're trying to look at this whole situation we have with public higher ed, especially for the research universities, you have to say, like, this is a fabulously successful program. So that's the point of view that the people who think that the system basically works, even though it needs efficiencies, believe. If you're on the other side and you have a market orientation, what you say is, well, that used to work, but now we need to, it's too expensive. Like, we're wasting money. We have overhead in the form of tenured professors. These guys are not productive. They get paid a lot of money, and we need to find a way to rewrite those labor contracts, and we need to outsource more, and we need to make this all a lot more efficient. But primarily where they're coming from is beyond the market orientation is a libertarian orientation. And that libertarian part of it says, what business does the government have spending money on education at all, from K through 12 and then in higher ed? Like, the purest form of libertarianism, that wasn't part of the original deal, right? That wasn't part of the Constitution. This is something that has allowed government to become huge. It's allowed the government to intrude in what we believe locally, in our school district, and it's helped create the system that now has people studying things that are useless and that cost us a lot. So at the core of the reformers' belief is that we should fundamentally cut the amount of money that the states get for this. And here's the other thing they believe. If you're going to walk out of a school like the University of Wisconsin, and you're in a program that's highly competitive, and let's say it's competitive with Stanford, and there are degrees you can get from there, from all these big public universities that are competitive with Stanford and Harvard and MIT. If you're going to come out with a degree that's competitive with a person that's coming out of a private university, then you should be prepared to pay for that. Like, the whole idea that we're going to underwrite this so that people that don't have wealth but who are, you know, really great at math can go in and become a scientist, that's really out the window for those people. That's not a concern. They look at it as a market and they're like, well, if you want a degree that's like MIT, go to MIT. And you find a way to pay for it. It's not our job to pick winners and losers to support people in this endeavor. It's up to you. The market will take care of it. And so there's a great desire to make the public universities cost a lot less for us to support as taxpayers.
Well, I mean, that to me, it seems to me, because, and I want to get to talk of the so-called HERO Act, like that whole idea of how to finance schools is just, I think, just incredibly disturbing in some respects, to be honest with you. But I mean, that idea, as you follow it through, where ultimately it's like, look, we want to spend less money on these universities. We don't really care if they exist or not. At the end of the day, we just want to spend less money on them because, it means less taxes. And you talk about LSU, you show LSU the implications of the massive income tax cuts by Bobby Jindal when he came in, and the federal money dried up in the wake of Katrina. Forgive the pun there. I imagine you could have found a similar story in Kansas. You definitely talk about Arthur Laffer in this, and Arthur Laffer, of course, I think people know he was the guru who convinced Ronald Reagan that if you cut taxes, you will actually increase revenue, because people will make more money now that they're getting more per dollar to keep more per dollar. Yeah. It's an incredibly disproven theory now, but if not, not before Sam Brownback ran Kansas into the ground. To what extent is this a philosophical? I mean, because when you put it in the way that the reason why these universities were set up, literally hundreds of years ago, was to build out a great country, to create the sort of in-house capacity for engineering, for a business, for diplomacy, for culture, right, in some ways. I could see someone making an argument. I think it's sort of would be wrong, but someone saying, like, as a country, we don't need those things anymore. What we need are service sector people and a smaller elite management class. And, opening the doors to all these people is not doing it. Are they making that argument? Or is the argument really, at the end of the day, look, we want to cut. We want to do what Grover Norquist did, which is just shrink government, and i.e. pay less taxes. I mean, which or is it a combination of, like, you have some ideological warriors, some genuine reformers, and some what is it?
I would say we're really the real. I won't say agenda, but the process that's happened since 1980 is the Grover Norquist one, where you cut taxes, it comes time to make a budget. And when the budget comes here, you're like, well, we don't have the money because we don't have the tax revenue, therefore we must cut. In this case, you could say this about a lot of sectors of government, but in this case, it's about public higher ed. So what they've done for 35 years is say, like, well, we don't have the tax revenue, we have to cut the support. And gradually, little by little, that pressure was moved from the state over onto the individual, right? So, like, for instance, at UT Austin in 1980, the state paid for about 60% of UT's budget. Now they pay for about 12%. So you did that over 35 years. It's like a glacier, it's like a change that's so gradual that people don't really have a fit about it until now, where people are going, like, this is outrageous. Like, we have all this. The tuition is outrageous, and the debt that flows from that is outrageous. So the real thing that's made this into a giant issue is the budgetary issue in terms of creating a problem. And what's happened is it's created a problem that everybody's now aware of. Like, everybody's upset about this. So it's created a problem that can now be solved by people who are stepping forward and going, like, well, we have these ideas for how to change this, and they never get to the, they never talk about, like, well, it took us 35 years to get to make this problem. They just come along and say, like, well, these places are grossly inefficient, and so we've got to fix it, and the way we can fix it is through this technology and through this budget cutting and so on. And there is a thing of, in terms of, as you said, like, about having a management class and then service sector people, and that's going to be the new paradigm, like, in the future. Well, there are people that are totally comfortable with that. And a lot of these people are Silicon Valley people who they're in the right place in the right time historically. They know how to write code. They know how to, like, make something work on the internet. So you wind up with things like Uber and Lyft and all these things. And for them, this is just an evolutionary thing, right? I can't really speak for them, but you can pick up on this, where it's like, well, if people don't have regular jobs, like, if they don't drive cabs, then that's just the way things happen, And if people have to work multiple sharing economy, which is totally, you know, I hate that because sharing is totally different from what they're talking about. Right. People have to have multiple sharing economy jobs. Then that's just how it's going to be in the future. Like, we can't be nostalgic. And meanwhile, like the robber barons of old, you have people who are in that position prepared to extract their percentage out of every transaction that's ever going to be made again through these services that now have people. So there, that concept is fairly mainstream. Like, that's really, if you really drill down into what people think about what the future is going to be like, they're not that uncomfortable with that idea. They just see it as the destiny that that this technology has given us.
Right. I mean, this
so
is
there's that.
This is the sort of classic neoliberal story, right? You have neoliberal and austerity policies, which underfund the public universities. That creates pressures and problems on the universities that can then be solved again by so-called market reforms. And this keeps going on and on until they are, in fact, no longer public universities in many
right.
respects. And
right.
you also touch on the Scott Walker getting rid of tenure in Wisconsin and it beginning to create a slow, maybe not so slow, a brain drain, essentially, from
right.
the University of Wisconsin. Because, of course, it would. I mean, if I'm one of the top,
yeah.
it diminishes the value of the educational experience. It also increases the cost of it simultaneously. And in that cycle just continues on. Let's talk about this HERO Act, because this is a proposal that I find particularly repugnant. And it's something that people should be aware of because, you know, Grover Norquist is all over this. And I told you before we got on, the attacks that we saw in the wake of the financial crisis on public sector unions had been telegraphed to me by Grover Norquist a couple of years earlier when I had hosted him some comedy show in Aspen. And that's all he could talk about in a room with no TV, no audio devices, just supposedly a funny live stage performance that turned into this sort of weird thing where I had to say to him, like, who are you talking to? We're not talking about public sector unions. But it was obviously like what they were pushing. And I am convinced that this is the destruction of public education, whether it's, you know, downstream or upstream, if you will, is the next project. And this is what's floating around out there now to how to deal with paying for college. I mean, we have over
right.
$1 trillion of student debt.
Right, right. So the HERO Act is it's a piece of legislation that Marco Rubio signed on to, and we have Rubio in the film talking about. And basically it's this. If you want to study somewhere, you can apply online for an individual or a corporation to pay for your tuition. And if you're studying something that they want to, that they think is going to be successful, then they will pay your tuition up front, the whole thing. In exchange, you commit to pay them 15% of your income for up to 30 years. And actually, if you read the fine print, it can be longer than 30 years. Like, if you have a couple of years of bad luck, you're unemployed, they'll just defer it and they'll keep it getting extended. So as your income grows, that 15% grows. And so for 30 years, you're basically sending them that percentage of your income. And it's, you know, people are astonished when they see the movie because it is a version of indentured servitude. And it's only a person with no money is given this option. In other words, if I have come from a family that can afford to pay my tuition, I don't have to be indentured. I can pay it and keep going. Yes.
This thing is so warped in so many different ways. Let me just add on to that. So one thing you have just I think most people recoil at the idea that for 30 years you'd be in this indentured servitude, regardless of your status as you enter into this agreement. Right. But like you,
right.
you point out, it's only going to be low income people who are doing this. So the And the cost is fixed, right? I mean, so it's the same for the rich person as is for a poor person. It's just that your upside all goes back to that rentier class, essentially. And talk about an accelerator for income disparity. I mean, it is basically saying, like, you know, the wealthy, the parents of the guy who can afford to go to college is actually going to be making exponential sums off of the person they're going to school with years to come.
Right.
That wealth disparity is going to be maximized. And then on top of that, we're going to have no teachers. We're going to have no social workers. We're going to have no artists. Right. We're going to have no musicians, because I'm going to invest in whatever industry I think is going to pop later.
Right.
And it's going to completely distort our job market. And then not only that, that's assuming everything works as it's supposed to, because if I only finance engineers because I think they're going to pay off, this is such an enormously bad idea that it doesn't even seem real to me, that it just seems to be like some type of smokescreen as a way of like cutting support to go to school.
No, you know, that came right out of the American Enterprise Institute. And in the film, there's a part of a presentation by one of their guys. He literally says, it's right before an edit, you have to really pay attention, but he literally says, yeah, and funders are going to get led to find people who generate a positive return on investment. He literally says that. So a person now is a source of a positive return on investment. It's unbelievable. And the guy almost doesn't say it. I think as that's coming out of your mouth, you have to go like, wait a second, that doesn't quite sound right. But he does. And it's just like, oh my God. Bobby's a great positive return on investment. Let's pay for that guy.
Assuming that Bobby makes the right choices, and I'll go over his portfolio. The other thing that you did not touch on in the movie, but I think it's really important to assess. I mean, you talk about how dramatic the price increases have been in the state universities in terms of tuition, but it seems to me that there has been no greater driver of the increase in tuition in private universities than the fact that public universities have increased their tuition so much. Can you talk about that to the extent that you're aware of this? Because it seems to me that, you know, you're talking about institutions that used to be the lowest cost option and cross-rent with actually getting a good education. And as that price goes up, it necessarily forces the prices of private institutions to go higher.
Well, you know, I really can't say about that. I think that your logic is correct. And there's even space made for private institutions to easily stay competitive as they see the cost of the public universities that are competitive with them change. I mean, but I can't say that, and we didn't get into that in the movie, so I don't really have evidence to support that, but I can see where it's kind of logical that would happen. I think the main thing to take away from this about the public higher ed versus private higher ed, and that is the public universities are under all this pressure, and they're under this pressure because they're answerable to the state legislatures. So the legislatures have control over the budget. They also have control over what happens. Like at UT Austin here, now, as of this semester, you can carry a concealed weapon on campus. And the reason why UT had to accept that is because UT gets 12% of its whole budget from the state. So they can't say no. And this is not in the film. We didn't get into the handgun thing. But it's an example. Like in Texas, if you go to a private school like Baylor, they have the legal right to opt out of a concealed handgun carry law because it's a private school. So it's the most ironic thing that you could ask for. And so it's also illustrative of how this is going to make public universities non-competitive. Because already we know from this handgun thing that if people have a choice to teach where they don't have handguns on campus and they have a brain, they're going to go there. And we also know that places that don't have to bend to the will of like the North Carolina legislature, for instance, are going to look for a better option in a place where the tenure is secure. So all these measures are experiments that are being perpetrated on these public universities, and it's not happening in the private side. So the private side can sit back and let this happen and benefit from it because of the brain drain that you talk about and from all the other factors where people go like, look, if I'm going to spend almost as much to go to the University of Wisconsin as I will to go to MIT, well, I'm just going to go to MIT, like if I had that. So it's a problem. It's a unique problem for public universities.
Is there any, I mean, is there any chance of reversing this short of, you know, changes electorally in the states? I mean, you mentioned the Koch brothers and Arthur Pope, who is obviously huge in North Carolina in terms of like being able to sway, you know, these local elections. And we've talked on this program about, you know, sort of the redistricting and the challenges there. And I think people are quite aware that there's been there are now 30 some odd states that have been taken over essentially by Republicans, and all of the stories that you're talking about, for the most part, Republican-dominated states, or at least in terms of these programmatically, have been done with Republicans. I mean, is there a solution to this, or is it just hoping a greater consciousness?
Well, the first thing is we think that people are largely unaware of the story the way that we framed it in the movie. The people from the alumni associations, the students, they don't really know about this. And they come back to a campus once a year and they go like, hey, the place looks great. But they don't know what is changing underneath and how that's going to essentially be detrimental to the school. So knowing about it is, I think, the first thing. Like, there's a 12-step program. The first step is like, recognize you have a problem. So and that will be a wild success for us if that happens. I do think this is uniquely a nonpartisan issue. That's what's ironic about it. If I have a kid in Texas and I'm a Republican, and I'm going to have to pay what the Democrat next to me is going to pay, right, to get my kid into this program. And I'm paying more because of historical decisions that are made by one legislature after another, all these people who signed off the Grover Norquist Pledge and who take money from the Koch brothers. And so we do think optimistically that there is space to have a discussion about this and have people rethink their possibly not very well thought out idea about taxing and spending and say, look, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face in this particular instance. Like, you can make a case and say, like, this is where people have to have discretion. Like, we're not trying to change you from your political belief. We're trying to say to you, in this case, we're not trying to say anything, but the evidence is there that in this particular case, you have to rethink this idea that we will never raise taxes and that we will always cut budgets and be intelligent about that. And so that's the hope, I think, that people know about it, they get to think about it, they ask their representatives about it, that it becomes an issue where people have to move. Like, people have to move off of their like, rigid ideology and go like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, I get this. This is a problem. So that's the optimistic view of it, that's possible. And I think it is. Like, and we see that already politically. Like, when people understand an issue that they can advocate in ways that are surprising. Well, and pressure can be brought to bear about that.
Steve Mims, writer, director of Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. I hope you're right. I hope folks see this film. They can go to starvingthebeast.net to get a notion of where they can see the film. I appreciate your time today, Steve. Thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks. I'm going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls and we will take your IMs. and we will discuss the budget deal. Another perfect example. We've talked in the past about the SEC directive, or I should say the executive branch's directive to the SEC to institute a rule. The SEC has authority to institute a rule that forces disclosure by companies to their own shareholders as to the money they are spending in politics. Right? Which makes sense. If I'm a shareholder, theoretically, I own a small piece of the company. And there should be some disclosure if the profits or money's generated, I guess not profits necessarily, but the revenue generated by the business is going towards political donations. And as part of this budget deal, the GOP once again has successfully included a provision that blocks regulators from doing so. And now the Democrats managed to get things like defunding Planned Parenthood, or, I don't know, making everyone sign a pledge that they'll be straight, stripped from the budget deal. There are monies that are not included in the budget for the Flint to deal with their water crisis, supposedly as a side deal. There is another piece of legislation. I'm not sure what that legislation is called off the top of my head, but there, the Flint funding is coming in the form of another legislation. The Senate passed a version that includes $220 million to replace Flint's water system. The House voted on Wednesday on its own bill, which provides $170 million for Flint. The final bill will be worked out between negotiators from the House and the Senate in conference. Maybe it'll be 190 or 200, but it won't be as part of this bill as opposed to other monies that will be going to places like, I don't know, flood victims or whatnot. So Stabenow and Gary Peters voted against this because why shouldn't Flint get the money now as opposed to 2 months from now? And that's a great question. I don't know, frankly, to be honest with you, I haven't spoken to any reporters. It's like, why is Flint being singled out not to get that money? I suspect on some level maybe it has to do with the Republicans don't want to draw attention to it, but I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. But nevertheless, there is a difference as to who controls Congress and who controls the Senate. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. The IM is at Majority FM. Don't forget, you can become a member of this show by becoming a member of this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It's your membership that makes this show possible. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, you buy it from Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Is it already Thursday? See you tomorrow.